Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo, and the team at The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we're talking about the world of recruitment and talent and some of the synergies with learning. I am delighted to welcome Katrina Collier to the podcast. Thank you for joining us, Katrina. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. Because we've known each other for ages, haven't we, from the past, like Disrupt HR, etc. But my experience is recruitment. So when I moved over here in 2003 from Australia, I fell into the industry like everybody does. I've worked agency, I've worked in-house, and then I started teaching social recruiting all around the 2008-09 crash. It was a little bit early. So started properly in 2012. And then I was doing that right up until Kogan Page asked me if I would like to write a book. So I ended up writing The Robot Proof Recruiter, which to this day blows my mind that that happened. And I've just actually released a second edition. And what I do these days, because I found the training kind of dissatisfying, which I'm sure we'll go into further, is today I run design thinking workshops with companies to help them fix their recruitment and talent acquisition, or talent acquisition and candidate experience. And I also run a coaching mentoring program with recruiters to just to help them really with the human skills, because there's so much focus on data and tech and tools and not the humans. And of course, as you would know, you've seen me speak, I speak all around the world, which is kind of mind-blowing. I didn't set out to have that happen, but it has. So there's sort of what I get up to these days.
So you've got this sort of eclectic career where you're doing little bits of it. And I know we've had the conversation in the past and you've said to me, you don't do learning. And I think a lot of what you do is learning. So, and you touched upon there that you've sort of stepped away from doing training. So what's taken you on that journey from the approach you started with to what you're doing now, and why have you made that transition?
Yeah, I mean, shockingly, I was delivering training without absolutely any experience. All I had was my recruitment experience and this want to share how to use social media to recruit and just teaching it. I was just, you know, I'm sure I made many errors along the way, but I seemed to keep clients, so that was something. But it was the fact that with the biggest intention in the world, most people take the training and discard 95% of it. So you'd give it your all and all of your energy and you'd share all this knowledge, and then they wouldn't use it. And that was sort of, I just found that quite, heartbreaking. The only time that I have seen training used was working for Hope for Justice, you know, going out to Kampala in Uganda, where they don't have this ability to just get trained all the time. They can't just go and buy some more if they don't use what they've been through. So they would use all of it. But unfortunately, you know, in the UK and Europe, and I mean, even the US, for example, that it's, there's so much training around that they don't realize how valuable it is and they don't implement it. So I got tired of that. So Chris Rohr suggested, why don't you do this design thinking? And that's what led to the design thinking workshops, which is a completely different. It's not training. I'm there to guide and there to facilitate a process. It's very, very different to me just standing, pouring out all this knowledge that gets discarded.
Which is interesting, because I think that's a natural transition for anyone in learning, because you started out as a subject matter expert and you almost get into that space, and there's the sage on the stage and you've got to share all of your wisdom and people are meant to buy into that, etc.
Lap it up
and, you know, feed your ego and all of those other things that happen in that environment. And then, as you said, you're realizing that it might not be at the right time, people might not value it, people might not be able to apply it. So you've moved over to design thinking. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how that works and why you think it's more impactful?
Mostly because people don't like being told what to do. In general, by the way, I do think that a lot of people don't apply the learning, because when they get back to the real world, they're not given the time to apply the learning. That is also a huge problem. It's not necessarily they intend to discard 95% of it. That's just day-to-day gets in the way. But the premise of design thinking is that it's collaborative. It's anonymous, because people write on post-it notes. Well, anonymous to a point. Obviously, someone could know your handwriting, but mostly anonymous. So people tend to share more. It's you're collecting people's thoughts. Like, what's going wrong? What could we do better? And they're writing it on post-it notes, they're heat mapping it, by voting on what's the biggest problem. And then they're designing solutions, and then they're working out how they'd implement the solutions. And so everyone's bought into the process. So rather than I come in and say, I could go into companies and say, look, this is what's wrong with your candidate experience. It's clear as day, right? Because I can see it. I'm an outsider. I'm not stuck in the process. But because I come in and facilitate a process, they share where they think it's going wrong. They agree collectively what's the biggest problem to fix and how they're going to fix it. And exactly, they leave the room like with a map of this is what we're going to do. And it's much easier to then go off and implement that because it's less overwhelming. But most importantly, they're all bought into it because collectively they've gone, this is the problem. Everyone has heard. And I like that actually, as a quite a loud person who will tend to talk over people and occasionally force my ideas on them, even though I'm trying to get better at not doing that. I think it's the trainer thing, isn't it? You just can't, it's very hard to switch off. I like it because the quiet people often have the best ideas and don't necessarily get heard. So this process, they get heard. But I'm there to facilitate. I'm not there to share my expertise. And I'll only put the expertise hat on if they ask for it, which they sometimes do. So it's very different. I just find it much more impactful.
And when I listen to that, I completely agree with you because my learner trainer journey went on to facilitation very early. In similar way to you, I realized no one wants to come and listen to some pre-made stuff that I've done. They want to work through their own issues and get to their own solutions that they feel ownership with, they can take back into a business and that they can solve. And yes, you might need to prompt and guide them and signpost and occasionally input some different thoughts or play devil's advocate to some ideas. So there's different roles you're playing as a facilitator. But I think what's always interesting to me is that the outcome is not learning. Learning is not the desired outcome. Actually, a change of how you do things, an impact on the behavior, an impact on the business is the outcome. Yeah. And learning is a byproduct. And I think that's sometimes where we go wrong in learning, that we think, let's do some learning, let's impart some knowledge, let's impart some skill. But if people, to your earlier point, don't have the time or the motivation or the collective drive to implement those changes, it's just throwing stones in the ocean. It's just wasting everyone's time.
It's funny you say that. I'll never forget this. I mean, being called in by the HR business partner actually to train the recruiters, and one of the in-house recruiters, all her job was to manage the agencies. So she sat through, I mean, let's call it endured my day of training, and I'll never forget her just walking out and leaving the training manual sitting there. And it was just frustrating because what I was imparting was, one, it would robot-proof her for the future because she'd have these incredible sourcing skills, but it was just the complete disregard that this could be a different path, a different possibility, a different direction for her. And it was just, I mean, it was probably one of the starts of the nails in the coffin of me just not wanting to do this anymore. But you're right, it is behavioral change that comes out of these workshops. And I think what's really interesting is one I ran recently, somebody tried to be the dominant person in the room. They wanted their idea heard. They ignored what was democratically decided. And it was quite interesting watching the group collective nip that in the bud. And that is also doesn't necessarily happen in traditional training.
No, and you again, depending on training, but if you've got that collective team in there, they're focused, you're able to draw them to a sense of consensus, as you said, on what the problem is, what the opportunities are to solve that, and then which one they're going to do and why. It doesn't allow that sort of just, oh yeah, it's Katrina, she came in, she talked about some nonsense that happens in other organisations, that won't work here. It removes all of that stuff straight away because they've applied it into their business, and it creates, as you said, those lesser voices in the room can come up with the great ideas that are maybe talked over, shouted down, or silently bullied away within certain businesses.
But it's also the defensiveness as well. So I will be running a workshop soon, which will actually be with hiring managers. And it's quite cute. He's calling them millennial hiring managers. And I mean, you could call them Gen Z hiring managers. They're very different to Generation X and the boomers. We did what we were told because it was, we went into the world of work before the internet, before the transparency of how many other jobs were out there and that ability to, you know, move and feel that fearlessness that you could move. And they're different. They want collaborative, right? But of course, I could just go in and we could just go in and deliver interview training, because to be fair, that's what's wrong. But actually, we're going to go in and do, he's calling it like a diagnostic workshop. Come in and let them decide that they need that interview training, and then we'll get the interview training. Because then they're open to it, and they'll all be open to it, rather than we've identified this is what you need. They get all defensive, go, I don't need that. I've been interviewing for at least 5 minutes. I know what I'm doing. And it's, so that's the other reason I quite like it.
Yeah.
So it can be and used for all manner of issues as well, which is quite exciting. I never know what I'm going to be up to. What problem are we fixing this week?
And I, you know, having worked in-house and managed both recruitment functions, learning functions, wider talent functions, HR teams, I think the synergies across the process are important as well, because so many people just see their little part of the process or their little silo. And I think within workshops like you're running or approaches we'll take with clients, it's all about trying to get them to see that bigger picture and journey, and then what they can do to change their part to make that bigger picture work. And and people through, you know, no fault of their own, or potentially because they're quite narrowly focused, or sometimes because they think they know more than they do. We all have those moments, don't we? That they don't recognize that impact or recognize there could be a different way of doing it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest issues with recruitment and talent acquisition, and I say this a lot, and you know, some of your HR listeners might be offended, but that it's ignored. It's ridiculous. You know, these are the human beings bringing in the people that decide the fate of the company. And it's almost like this, all of the traditional training that exists around HR and the, all of the qualifications, whether it's CIPD or SHRM, just seem to overlook talent acquisition and the importance of it. I just find it quite extraordinary. There are no real formal qualifications for it either. So it also means, you know, the people perhaps have done a traditional CIPD course and they've got through so many levels, and so therefore feel they have the right to have that experience. And it's like, no, this is, it's overlooked so often. I'm forever talking to HR event organizers saying, where is TA? Why isn't it on the agenda? Because if you brought in better people, HR would have less to do, just a thought. You know, you should be partnering as well. So whenever there's a handoff from the recruiters to HR, this is when people drop out of the process. Because again, they can see all the jobs out there. They're being, you know, called in for interviews all the time. Even though there's talk of a recession, even a global recession, there's still a shortage of people in certain industries. So it's all the different areas need to work better together. But there's a sort of a lack of education around it almost. Hence, I keep ranting about it.
I think there's a, you know, there's so many different HR models out there. And, you know, whether you're a single HR person operating as your own, fulfilling, you know, the TA role, the HR role, any other thing that someone wants to throw at you, learning.
God help that poor person.
Org development, org design, you know, there's all of those different things can operate within one person within a micro business or a smaller business, or they can operate within huge businesses in silos with multiple sets of politics sat across that and no real collective synergy or vision, or to the other model you've talked about. And there's lots of similarity between recruitment and learning teams in this. Sometimes you are a glorified procurement professional because all you are doing is managing the outsourced contract, whether that's an RPO or whatever that happens to be. In learning, you can just be putting out some tenders, getting some people to deliver some courses, and acting almost as that facilitator between some orders of the business and some external providers. And so all of those different things in business create, there is not one way of doing HR, or there is not one way of doing it, which is why I think the powerful approach that you're taking of actually getting into the business and saying, what are you working on? Here's some good practice. Here's a process to take you through to understand what's right for you. Because there's a real tendency in HR.
What's going wrong here? And what? How can we fix it here?
Exactly, because the best practice from down the road is not going to be your best practice and right for you. And I think sometimes if you're in that position of an HR person, you don't have expertise in everywhere, the easiest way is just to go, the competition are doing it over there like this, or we should be doing this, or I hear the press saying that we should be doing this type of stuff. And a lot of that is driven by marketing of some of the providers, etc. And that creates a really poor service generally.
Yeah. Exactly. It's to take a step back and see, to be able to look at your own organization and see where it's falling down. There is, I mean, certainly, I believe from HR professionals I'm talking to, recruitment and retention is a massive problem. And then so much of that goes into L&D, doesn't it? But if the people aren't talking, you know, in-house recruiters should be asking first, well, who do we have internally that could do this job? And promoting someone in or cross-training and then backfilling. And then, you know, that sort of internal mobility piece on top of the retention piece, it's just overlooked. Everyone, as you said, is in silos. It's work to be done.
Definitely is. So going back to the book you've written and recently yes. re-released and with an updated yes. version. So for those yes, of our listeners exciting. Who haven't yet read your book, do you want to yes. highlight what's the book about? Just summarize to me what the book's about and why you wrote it, apart from Cogan Page coming and saying, can you write a book? But what was your
Let's
drive behind
never
it?
Get over that moment. I would just like to say no degree failed English was asked by a publisher to write a book. I just like blows my little brain. When they came to me, which was 2018, was about the time, and I bet this has happened to L&D professionals as well, that all of the HR tech vendors were saying that recruiters are replaceable. And it was like, yeah, sure. Can I please write a book called The Robot Proof Recruiter and talk about why they're not? And that's what I ended up writing. And it is all about, look, use the technology, sure. You know, I'm an avid lover of tech. It's quite hilarious. People think I'm not, but I am. But you use it to create better human connection, not to spam, not to get in the way, not to distance yourself from the human being. You use it to make it easier. You know, you think about the ease of online shopping. You know, you see the item you want to buy, you see the reviews, you pop it in your basket, it's purchased. We've made recruitment so much more complicated than that, because the HR tech vendors are saying, well, if you do this and you do this, you won't need people. No, you definitely need people. So that's how it came about. And just to prove my point that you still need people, there are still cashiers in the bank, even though we have automatic teller machines. And there are still people doing your shopping, you know, at the supermarket, even though there's also the automatic checkout points. They're just mundane transactions. Nobody's going to hand their career to a robot. So recruiters will always be needed. So that's how it came about. What I didn't want was for anybody to go, and when did you last recruit, Katrina? Because it has been a while. So I got in, I mean, the first book, there were 74 people who helped write the book with me. Like, I took their examples and their contributions and I put them in there to inspire others. And in addition to, I mean, the same 74 plus, probably another 10 or 15. It's been given a bit of a pandemic overhaul. The paragraph on flexible working was quite hysterically funny when I reread it after the pandemic. And new examples. And if anything, I felt almost an element of sadness, because I thought after what recruiters had been through in 2020, you know, they're the department like L&D that gets laid off really quickly when there's a downturn, that they would have more compassion and more empathy and more, you know, understanding of what it's like to go through the awful, awful recruitment processes that most companies expect people to go through. Sadly, they didn't. So there's a lot about that in there. And then just different examples of just how bold people are now. You know, if you are messing up the lives of people, they are writing it in places like LinkedIn. There's no fear. You know, when I started in the world of work, you wouldn't have risked your career by having a bad reputation. Now people just don't care because they know that the other companies will pick them up. The latest one I saw like this week was lots and lots of people complaining about hours upon hours upon hours interviewing at Aldi to receive no feedback. Just an automated, heartless email after they've given irreplaceable time. So there's a lot about that in there, just about human first, technology second. It's mind blowing.
I think when I've read the book, you know, things that I recognize a lot of the stuff you're talking about from the recruitment world, but thinking about how that translates across into the world of learning and these sort of process taking over just beyond common sense almost, or we're stuck with the things of the past. So, you know, it might have been a good idea to, when there was a market where, you know, you had a limited amount of people, you know, or a load of people coming for a job, and you could choose, you could take your time, you could slow things down. We're in a very different world. We're in very different expectations. People are not coming to you for an expectation that they can stay with you for 5, 10 years. Then they're going to stay with you until you break that emotional contract, or until they feel they can get a better deal elsewhere, or their life changes, or all sorts of other things. So we're in a very different cultural world to maybe when you and I started in recruitment. Yet some of those underpinning processes are hanging on for dear life, underpinning a lot of what we do. And therefore, there isn't any common sense, because they've overlaid tech to make some of those processes easier. And as you said, almost dehumanize the process and lose all of the good bits.
But it's funny when you were saying that, I was thinking of the human attitude shift as well. It hasn't necessarily happened. I mean, I think the longest that I've had at one company is 5 years. I've like had certain industries for longer, but the longest actual stretches have always been 5 years, which for Gen X is actually quite short. But there's also there's still a problem with people having gaps on their CVs. You know, with this reluctance of managers to look beyond that, or recruiters to look beyond that. So there's still some interesting biases that need to get worked out. You know, with the that's still that old school mentality to the way people will have careers going forward. You know, as you know, you've discovered you've stepped off into the world of self-employed or entrepreneurship or whatever you'd like to call it. That ability, we don't have to work all the time. We can have gaps. We can take time off and, you know, come back to a project and things like that. But of course, people don't see that because they just see Katrina Collier Limited in a chunk of time. They don't understand that, you know, I'm off for 3 weeks, for example, to Australia and India, and I can do that. You know, and that gap could be 3 months and it wouldn't matter. But when it's employment, it's bizarre how we still have this attitude that needs to shift. Whereas it could be somebody's off getting life experiences, which will enrich their next job. They're learning about resilience and different things.
And I love that point about almost the holistic nature of experience or learning, or where you gain experience, skill, context, balance, even in what you're doing, because spin that back into learning. And, you know, traditionally, you come to the learning team who control what you learn. They control the budgets, they control access, they almost ration you. So it's, you know, this is a resource that you can only have X amount per year. Whereas if we spin the thought the other way around and go, let's empower everyone to do as much as they possibly can because they're going to be better. Why should I have to wait a year for that course? Or why should I have to go through a convoluted application process to a program to get me onto a high potential program to move up in my own business, where
Agreed.
I'm just sat there going, well, actually, I want to get on in this business. Why should my manager, who may or may not be the best person in the world, may want to keep me for the right or wrong reasons, be a block to me getting that progression? Because there isn't a block for that progression if I go and apply for another business, or if I go and look
Exactly.
elsewhere. So
And
I
that's
think
what will happen. So I think
to
that
be
comes
more
back to,
mature.
yeah, and I think that comes back to you. I mean, you're saying that and I'm laughing because it's like, you know, I run a coaching and mentoring program that people can't get £100 a month for 3 hours of, it's group coaching. They can't get permission to join that. And you're just like, really? They're going to become exceptional recruiters. You know, they're going to be, you know, making, well, if they're on the agency side, they'll make more placements, a direct impact. Or if they're in-house, they're going to create ease and better process and better candidate experience, better employer brand, and on it goes. And you're just like, it's £100 a month. Like, and they can't get sign-off. Or we don't have training. The people that bring in the people that decide the fate of the company aren't given budgets. I am, of course, generalizing. Of course, there are companies out there that do that. There was another point I wanted to make, but it's gone out of my head.
But I think there's lots of those, you know, issues that cause that thinking, whether that's a lack of budget, whether that's a lack of foresight, whether that's,
Oh, I know what it was. A lack of, oh my gosh, I better not train this person up. They'll be better than me. They'll show me up. And I think that happens a lot. Like a lot.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, we see this in learning teams quite often, where something is given to a junior member of staff because it's maybe not very important, like, you know, learner experience or learning tech, or, you know, something newfangled nonsense that, you know, you can just go and find something, pick something off the shelf. and someone will go through that journey of learning that, and they'll suddenly pop out and be far more aware and knowledgeable from their manager, and you see this real shift in balance as this is not quite something I can control and know everything about, you know. The world is moving so quickly.
And I think this is the trouble for leaders, well, for managers that need to become leaders, so they need to spend less time managing, covering their butt, giving rules and regulations, and more time leading and guiding and growing and coaching. And it's such a different world, you know. It really is. I mean, even in the nearly 20 years I've been in recruitment, but let alone the 30 years I've been in the world of work, I mean, it's so different. The internet specifically has created the biggest change. I mean, we wouldn't even be doing this right now if it wasn't for the internet. You know, you're at your home, I'm at my home, we're using Teams, and so with the internet, right? It just didn't exist. But then there's just the technology as well. And that, as you're saying, that ever changing. And you think about the generation that's coming into the workforce now who've had technology in their hands the whole time. And any boomer or Gen X listeners, please don't complain about them. We created them. We gave them the tools and the technology and the internet, right? So we can't complain. But they probably want different learning. You know, they are that TikTok generation. They're used to gathering their information from a crowd in short spurts. You know, we're used to the more formal classroom-based education, which was certainly not right for everybody, but it was never tailored and altered. And it's just, it is hard. I get that. I understand that. But I just think, empower your people. What would you yourself learn if you empowered your people? You probably grow so much. And there is something so satisfying by watching people flourish. And honestly, if you're a manager and you don't want to see your people flourish, go and find something else to do. Don't be a manager. Yeah, I chose to not manage a team. When I was in my recruitment agency days, it sort of came up in conversation, I just laughed because I would just be dreadful at it. Because it'd be like, if I told you what to do, James, and you didn't do it, I wouldn't know how to handle that. I'd just be frustrated. But I've become a leader without meaning to be. That was never my intent. Because I get such a kick out of seeing other people grow and flourish. And it's just, you know, if you're not going to do that, do something that means you're not influencing a team. I don't quite know what that would be. I'm thinking something really boring, I have to say.
I think it's knowing, and again, lots of this is driven by ego or insecurity or, you know, possibly even a lack of curiosity or sometimes around risk. So we see a lot of people make fairly mundane, relatively safe decisions because it won't lose them their job, or it's not going to, you know, it's what's expected.
There's an internet out there, people. There's an internet. Go and look for another job.
But you see it, and you know, you've talked about getting people in the room and doing, you know, design thinking and coming up with a new way of doing things. And that's challenging and scary for someone who wants to know everything, wants to know more than anyone else, wants to have been in front of people. And I know they shouldn't be the leaders in teams, but sometimes you have corporate cultures. And, you know, it's very easy to sit on the outside of saying, well, actually, you don't have a learning culture if you can't ever make a mistake. You can't have a learning culture if you don't have an ability to not be 100% right the first time, or to be able to iterate to get to where you are. But there are still in some businesses those overarching fear cultures that mean that people are reticent to take that risk, to think outside the box, to say, I'm going to spend X 100,000 pounds on this design thinking workshop for my team, which is going to get people. £3.50.
I would like to address the fact that actually the process isn't scary at all. One, because I have an amazing ability to create a safe space. I don't know what it is. It's just ingrained in my soul, and people just tell me stuff. So in that respect, I mean, it's good, because I guess, like I was saying, if you don't enjoy being a manager, don't do it. And I just love doing this. I thrive doing this, so I do it. It's my thing. It makes me sit up. But actually, no, the process is quite safe. You know, everybody feels that they can contribute, and there's no the thing is, because they're coming together as a team to decide this solution would fix this problem, and this is how we could, this is, so say we go, we need interview training. They will then work out how they're going to get that interview training. What are the next steps they're going to take to be in a position, right, we're rolling out the interview training. So it's gently mapped out. So she, I do find it in that respect quite safe. However, going back to the toxic blame culture, when I was speaking at In-House Recruitment Live in London recently, it was actually fun because I just did a, like, how to handle hectic hiring managers and did a live coaching session. It was great fun. Rather than actually just talk at people, I decided to make it really interactive. And, you know, this person said, how do I get my hiring managers to make a decision? They just have so much fear to not do that. And I said, how many interviews are people going through? Oh, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, you have a blame culture. You have a leadership problem. You have a blame culture. That, you know, that's what you have to fix. And unfortunately for you, you're not really, as a recruiter, in a position to fix that. However, there are other companies out there looking for work or looking for recruiters, which I shouldn't say, but it's like, if you're stuck in a company like that and you cannot bring in somebody to help fix the culture, whoever that somebody is, whatever that, it's always going to be a human, and that's not going to be fixed by tech, then you do just need to leave. And of course, they would have a really, I'm sure, really low retention, really high turnover rate, really high failed recruitment rate. Because of the blame culture. And it's almost like there's a great divide, because there are just the companies that are so getting it right, and then there's the companies that are just stuck in the 1990s, apparently. We're not supposed to call it the 90s anymore. Doesn't it sound like forever ago when you say 1990s?
Unfortunately, it is. When you look back, feels like yesterday, but when you look back, it is actually 20, 30 years ago, or more than that.
Yeah.
So
it's funny because I've started writing a book about my life. So about my child abuse and everything that I threw at it to get over it. And it's funny because I've been revisiting that time. And even just when I met Richard, my now ex-husband, but the reason that I came to London and trying to communicate long distance in the late 1990s, which just sounds forever ago, but it was, you know, just those 22, 23 years ago, we didn't have this. We couldn't just jump on a video chat. We were making long distance phone calls. We couldn't talk over data. It was still dial up. You know, it's just like quite mind blowing how the world's changed. And so I understand how people, you know, in L&D or in recruitment or leaders or whatever, are struggling to keep up with the pace of change. It's very different. Yeah, the fundamentals of being kind to somebody through the recruitment process have not changed at all.
And you've obviously sort of revisited the book, and you've looked at it post-pandemic and post whatever changes we've been through over the last 3 years. Oh, and you talked about what haven't we been through? But, you know, it's interesting, that point of time, because you touched on a point earlier about, you know, some of the bits didn't stand up maybe over a couple of years, because you look back and you go, yeah, the world's moved a bit. But what are those changes that people have seen across that, you know, sort of 74 sets of people that are contributing to your group and the wider thing? What are the themes you've seen that really have changed, and not just the hot air that we hear about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big one was, of course, the flexible working. So the book is written for people who recruit people that have skills that are in demand. Okay, it is not, you know, for high volume recruitment, which, you know, thinking of your background, you know, you used to be in the high volume recruitment, didn't you, in the pubs? But even those are struggling now, to be fair, because, of course, because of 2020, so many people left the industry. So it is written for that space. So I sort of caveat with that. But how empowered people have become. You know, many people who perhaps were not avid technical or technology users became very avid because they had to, because suddenly they're working from home, you know, having to think about their tech setup and think about how they conducted their day and all this sort of stuff. And then many just went, yeah, I'm just not going back. That great realization of work-life balance, not wanting to be in the office, not wanting to commute, those sorts of things. So I think, you know, and I joked, because it was such a honor to be given any form of flexible or remote working before the pandemic. Whereas now it's like, well, if you don't give it to me, I'm not coming to work for you. Now, not everybody. There are people who want to work in the office 5 days a week. Majority want some form of hybrid. Vast majority do want to go in. They do see the benefits of going in and collaborating with their colleagues. And again, it's all this shift, and none of this will be new to you or your listener. It's just, it's the biggest change. But I think it's the, I'm talking about the empowerment, that realization that I can stand my ground. Now, again, I know we're talking about, I'm being distracted by my dog who sort of wants to come and join the conversation. I know that we are talking about perhaps going into a recession or whatever is happening. I mean, certainly let's not talk about what's happening in the UK. But the fact is that in technology and in health, for example, there's still a shortage of people. So they still have the choice, they still have the power, and they don't have to come and work for you. And that hasn't changed. It's just the determination I feel that people have. So it's almost become even harder. Because one of their first questions would be, do you allow remote? Do you allow flexible? Oh, you don't? Well, I'm not talking to you. It's less about, I think it was much more salary focused before. Now it's much more work-life balance, which I think is a good thing.
I think it is, and it's made a more demanding consumer in all, you know, of businesses as a whole. And everyone,
that's a great way of looking at it, a consumer of business, isn't it? We don't, for some reason.
No, I always view it that you should be there to say, why should I spend any valuable time in my life working with you? What's in it for me? And whether that's altruistic of actually I believe in the mission and the cause of what we're working on, or whether it is, you know, salary, or whether it's promotion or learning opportunities or balance or ethical alignment, people come with their own different shopping lists and different personas, consumer groups, whatever. And if we don't look at it like that and say, how are we meeting these needs? And, you know, you can paint the greatest shop window, but as you said, everything is now so transparent, and someone will come in and say, well, you said you were a great career opportunity, you know, place I could grow and build my career. But I came in, tried to get on the learning program and find I was 2 months late, or I hadn't hit my, I hadn't hit probation. Yeah. So I've got to wait another 15 months for the next round of getting that learning. And that's sometimes where the traditional set processes and ways of thinking that were maybe right at the time, but no one's thought to change. And I think that's where you often find is people don't look at it like a consumer. People don't walk their customer journey. You know, I've so many times in my career, I've said to hiring managers, I've said to senior managers, have you ever tried to apply for a job in your organization? And they never have. The same for, have you ever undertaken the learning your team are expected to do? No, I haven't got the time. You know, and unless we start walking those journeys and we start caring, we're not going to actually create something that's worth doing in lots of these spaces.
And the fact is, your people know. It's a case of listening to your people, isn't it? And I think that's why I love these workshops, because you're listening to your people. They're telling you. They won't tell you in one-to-one interviews. This is why in some ways it's better than you go, you know, go and bring the big four in, they'll interview all your people and they'll deliver you back a report and you'll be lost because you're like, oh my God, now I've got this monumental thing to read and try and implement. And I don't think people will tell the truth in those because they're still intimidated by them. But it's amazing what they write in a post-it note. But while you were saying all of that, I was thinking of going back to, you know, this person that, you know, just this week on LinkedIn has put this update about how many interviews, the presentation, everything she did for this, for to be a buyer. I'm sure it was little. And the fact she got no feedback. And one of the comments was just from somebody typical of his generation. He just said, they don't owe you anything. You should just be grateful that you get work. And I'm like, this is the problem. Because there is still that older generation. And I say that as a 51-year-old, you know, who's experienced it. I see both sides, who are saying, well, we didn't have this, so why should you? Now, they're not necessarily saying it out loud, but that's what's going on in the subconscious. That's what's creating this saboteur. He's just like, no. Well, you know, I didn't have it, so you're not having it. I think there's quite a difference in my generation. I think we're like a bridging generation, but just a little older. And of course, I'm grossly generalizing. There are absolutely fantastic in all age ranges and dreadful in all age ranges. But it's that, almost that weird, going back to the fear thing, that's almost a jealousy thing. Because again, we're all humans, aren't we? We're all humans in the workplace.
Yeah,
all trying to work together.
I had to wait, work this way up. I had to go, you know, we've heard that before, seen it. I had to wait 3 years. This was what we did. And I'm going to perpetuate that on everyone else. And sometimes that's worked really well for them. And it comes from good intentions. It's not necessarily about trying to slow people down. It's just, yes, this was my journey. That's what works. That's tried and tested. Yeah. That's what we're going to keep.
It was funny. Jess Larson was on Glenn Martin and I have a show called Hear the People, a live show every other Wednesday. And Jess Larson was on and she said, you know, it's like you're creating teams where you've got, you know, four different people who are all have different brains, which are all running their own programming language and they're all trying to code together. And she said, it's just, it's a challenge. But one of the conversations I've been having a lot recently with recruiters is how to get the hiring managers to understand. So perhaps sharing the interview questions ahead of time, because that creates equity for someone who perhaps has learning difficulties or just needs a little bit more time to think up answers, and how actually it leads to better conversations ultimately in the interview. But the rather than a memory game that you play, you're actually prepared and ready to have the conversation. But it's they think that they're giving people an advantage as opposed to actually making it a level playing field. And it's again, that's undoing all of these attitudes. Well, we didn't have that, so why should they have that? And it's complicated.
But yeah, it is. But again, it's
I hope
amazing.
Nobody came on this podcast thinking we'd solve their problem by the end of, you know, 30 minutes.
No, I think we're just highlighting some challenges. But I think it's sometimes, you know, to take that point you've just talked about, that you go through and it's like, well, it's a memory game or it's a guessing game or it's a person who's best on their feet who will go through that recruitment process. And you know, you talked earlier about, you know, 5 or 6 interview stages, which, you know, is because no one will take responsibility for making a decision alone because there's a blame culture and all of those things that actually tell you what the organization is like. You then see the other thing, if you go through all these elongated processes and then you get someone in on day one, it's like they've never done anything before, because we then patronize them with, you know, induction processes or you know, we don't actually start valuing their opinion because we've got to go through lots of other convoluted processes that don't work.
And I think that's why people don't start either, because now, if they're working remotely, which, you know, most people are doing at some point of the week, I am talking about knowledge workers, obviously, that they're still interviewing. So I give you a contract, you can sign the contract and still not start. You can even do your background screen and still not start, right? Until you physically walk in the door. That pre-boarding period where people want to feel like they're already part of something. And of course, like you're saying, they come in on day one and we suddenly treat them like they don't know anything. But actually they already, before they've even walked in the door, they've had the offer, they've hopefully signed it. You're meant to be wooing them in and luring them into feeling like they're already an employee, so that whatever their notice period is and they're still interviewing, they're still going to come and start.
Absolutely.
Because people will still be interviewing.
And that's the most, or, you know, together with that, you know, who are our talent in the first place and do we need to hire? Can we create internal mobility? Mm-hmm. That's a clear synergy between recruitment and learning where they can work better together.
Absolutely.
And the other bit is, you know, there's so many across the piece, but the other real one is that onboarding handover journey piece, because they're coming into a business where we've made a load of promises during that process. We've learned a lot about them. We've learned a lot about, they've learned a lot about us. And that congruence and synergy and everything else that runs through that needs to work, because, you know, you said that they might not even walk through the door, but, you know, I could be interviewing for 20 companies this week. Effectively, my ending process could be just a career turning up and taking my laptop and, you know, swapping over a different laptop. The level of engagement that you need to create and the way you do that needs to be far more creative, because there might be hybrid working, but for many, there's limited hybrid working now. So they might come in and experience a week of making you feel you fit into the company, which is a week away from home that doesn't reflect my working pattern. So again, there's still some of these clunky processes that haven't really thought about how does that buy into that person who's going, actually, flexible working is really important to me because I've got caring responsibilities. I've got this. But the first week in my job was stressy because I had to go to somewhere, you know, 100 miles from home, stay in a hotel. Who looked after my kids? Who looked after my elderly relatives? Whatever it happens to be. We haven't thought that through.
So I've got a story of this in the book where somebody started their remote onboarding journey, because some of these stories are from 2020, and you know, they're given their laptop by IT, but they're not given any of the logons. So there they are on their crappy Wi-Fi at that point, trying to download a whole system onto the computer because IT has sent them a laptop without any of the system on it while they're on their first day of the induction. So they're stressed to high hell because they're missing out in training while the stupid thing is trying to download, and, you know, friend is in the other room trying to work as well, and on it goes. So it's just, it's silly things like that. But a couple of things sprang to mind while you were saying that. One is there's a new story in the book from somebody who worked at a job board aggregator that we all know, who was, he walked into the Austin office and he saw the rainbow logo and he thought he'd found his tribe. So everything that you're saying about that, I've found my people. That's not how the company is, unfortunately, because of the parent company. They're actually quite homophobic. And therefore, he wrote an article on LinkedIn and it just sits there. It's very calm, very matter of fact, about the times he was overlooked, undermined, ideas stolen, didn't get promotions, et cetera, et cetera. His new boss is like cheering them on. But it's like on LinkedIn right there for the world to see, you know, transparent. But the other thing I think we're going to have now as a problem as we move into this uncertain recession time, I'm hearing stories like this. Somebody from South America is offered a contract for a job in North Europe, signs the contract, sells their house, sells their car, packs up their life, and 3 days before they're due to start, the offer is rescinded. That person sold their house. They sold up their entire life to move from South America to Northern Europe. That's how they were treated. And there is going to be more of that. And I think through all of this, whether you're an L&D professional, HR professional, a talent acquisition professional, we are playing with people's lives. That's it. And most people are a couple of paychecks away from homelessness, and we can never forget that. So that man's life, he mightn't be able to get back on the property ladder. You know, it could be he can't rebuy, he couldn't cancel his contract. It could be, we don't know. It was 3 days before he was due to start. And it's just unfortunate. There's going to be a lot of that happening if you're in that blame culture company, you're in that knee-jerk reaction company, that HR doesn't have a seat at the table, it doesn't have a voice, it can't say, no, what are you doing? Let's not do this. I was talking to Elizabeth Lemke recently, and she was saying, we should not be hiring if we cannot keep somebody through a downturn. What recruiters ask that question? You know, it should be the first question. They're talking of recession out there. Are we going to be able to keep this person? What's going to happen? We can't. Let's not hire them. Let's get in a contractor, you know, and start pushing back and start having more business focused conversations, because we play with people's lives. So interesting times ahead. I mean, the 2020s, they've been nothing like the 1920s. I wouldn't call them roaring. Roller freaking coaster.
Looking into the future, Katrina, what's coming up next for you?
Well, I'm writing the other book. So personally, I have a feeling this may step me away from the whole world of recruitment, which is quite interesting. I'm writing about my childhood trauma, and not so much to like, let's sit here and talk about that and wallow in self-pity. Actually, know my journey to healing. So that's on a personal side. I've literally just started writing. It felt like the time was right. It's quite weird. As far as recruitment goes, I feel that there is a lot that needs to be bent back into shape, fixed. We need to remember the humans in the process. So I can see myself, you know, doing a lot more talking, a lot more workshops. I don't see that changing. It's needed. The Robot Proof Recruitment's just been rewritten. Edition 2 came out in August, so I don't feel the need for a third just at the moment. But who knows? That might happen as well. But, you know, to anybody listening, if you have friction between hiring managers, your in-house recruiters, or external for that matter, and HR is my sweet spot, just to fix that. Because however you are treating people, whether that's as an employee or as a candidate, it is on the internet. It is written. People will write. If it's particularly bad, they will especially write. And that stops future hiring. It stops retention. Nobody wants to work for a company that doesn't hire good people either. So, or develop them, of course. So it's, yeah, it's only going to get more transparent.
Absolutely. And there'll be nowhere to hide for those organisations who don't take any of this stuff seriously.
No.
So if someone has, you know, enjoyed listening to you, wants to get in touch, wants to follow your thoughts or keep, you know, do that, how do they best do that?
Well, the website is katrinacollier.com, so very complicated. so they'll find me there. Of course, all the usual places, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. Instagram is mostly dog snaps. But yeah, I probably share the most. I have a LinkedIn newsletter, which I do. Mind you, I have, of course, the show with Glenn, Hear the People. So that's a live show every other Wednesday. But yeah, LinkedIn, Twitter, all the usual, all the socials. Not TikTok, strangely. I've considered it. I just feel I might be a bit old.
Okay. So we will put all of those relevant places in the show notes below, apart from TikTok, as you're not there and maybe won't be going there.
Can I just say as well, I donated the royalties from the Robot Proof Recruiter to Hope for Justice charity. So if you're considering from this conversation purchasing a copy, please buy your entire team a copy, because the royalties just are doing such amazing work. Modern day slavery impacts now, they say, 50 million people around the world. So that's where the royalties go.
So loads of good stuff, not just for your team, but for wider as well. So yeah, Katrina, lovely to catch up and thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if the learning effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.